How are you? This is Cliff, your host of Earth Ancients, startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past. And it is Saturday, June 21st. It is the first day of summer. So I hope everyone's getting out there and enjoying the summer vibes. I guess it's the longest day of the year. So here in California, the sun probably won't be going down till significantly later than, I think last time I was out, it was at 8:30, 8:45, closer to 9, which is fantastic. If you're a hiker like I am, get the backpack on, get the water bottle, get the power bar, and you get out there. So welcome. There is quite a bit of information that I posted on the Facebook page this week. Probably of greatest interest to me is my associate, the Dutch engineer, Jan-Peter de Jong, posting some interior shots of Angkor Wat, the Cambodian ruin that they really don't have a true inception date for. It's been continually lived in or used for thousands and thousands of years. And he took a trip there a few years ago, and he has posted some immense granite blocks, some weighing 20 tons, which are interior supports that I've never been there, but has a great fascination with that location. And some of the photos are amazing. The precision in the cuts and engineering behind that facility, which is seriously in question now, because these blocks weighing multi-tons are so perfectly fitted together that it appears that some kind of technology must have been involved to fit them in such a way 3,000-4,000 years ago, and align them and then stack them. And then, of course, the real marker for Angkor Wat are these monstrous heads that sit upon high above these temples that look out. And he estimates that just one temple head weighs in excess of 100 tons. So that's an engineering feat that has to be looked at a little closer. And so I've posted a share from his site of about 7 to 8 photographs, and we're going to continue that with some unusual shots of the foundation area that leads out to a massive lake. And the interesting point on the foundation and this walkway is that each of those stones is between 1 and 1.5 tons, perfectly aligned, that lead out and around and create this this flooring that is not really closely viewed, but it's just taken for granted. So do take a look at that. Now, the other area that I have a great interest in is the megaliths of South America, and Peter and I are in the midst of working on a first draft for a book, but I have posted a couple of photos of Tiwanaku, Bolivia, and I plan to be out there with Jesus Gamara later this year to view this not only Cusco but Sacsayhuaman and up to the next level, which is a few miles away, which would be Machu Picchu. And of course, the unique part of that is these are megalithic builders, massive stones, dragged hundreds, well, excuse me, I'd say about 100 miles away from the quarries, and dragged up hills and laid in perfect alignment. And if you've been listening for the last few months and been reading Facebook, you'll know that Alfredo Gamara, Jose's father, is the actually developed the thinking behind the three worlds, the three different phases of the stonework that are appearing in not only Cusco but Sacsayhuaman and Machu Picchu And it seems like most of the ancient sites in Peru have these three phases of stonework. So it's a huge interest of mine. And who were these cultures? Who built these cultures? And that kind of leads into my guest today. And it's possibility that because of the age of these sites, that they could have had influence. Maybe they did have influence from much, much, much earlier civilizations. And when we, you know, consider the great age of these locations, we have to think. And I'm calling our guest right here. So you're there. And there you are. We just lost you for a minute, but
I don't know what happened.
It's okay. I'm still introducing you, Rand, but I'm talking about Tiwanaku, Bolivia, and I have posted some photographs there, and a number of researchers are perplexed at who could have built such amazing, refined pyramids out in the middle of nowhere. And there's a lot of interest in the possibility of it being from an Atlantis or a much, you know, earlier civilization. But anyhow, my guest today is Rand Flemoth. He's a librarian and co-author with his wife Rose of the Atlantis Blueprint. He's appeared on the History Channel, the Discovery Channel, NBC, CBC, and BBC, as well as numerous radio shows. And he's coming to us today from Vancouver Island, British Columbia. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah. So Atlantis Beneath the Ice, The Fate of the Lost Continent. Now, this is an updated version from an earlier book. Is that correct?
Yeah. Originally in 1995, we did When the Sky Fell, which was our first book together, and that did very well, and we've now done a new edition of it.
Okay.
Which so has the new title, Atlantis Beneath the Ice.
Atlantis Beneath the Ice, exactly. So
yes.
For those in our audience that are not familiar with your work, why don't you give us a quick overview of the premise of the new book and its relationship to the lost island of Atlantis. Just a real quick overview, and then we'll get into some of the book.
Okay, well, the book is about two things, really. It's about Atlantis, but it's also about a geological theory called Earth crust displacement, which is a displacement of the entire outer shell of the Earth, moving over the Earth's axis and resulting in traumatic climatic change. And we believe that prior to the last Earth crust displacement, the Earth's crust was positioned in a different relationship to the Earth's axis than it is today, such that North America was primarily within the polar zone, but Alaska and Siberia were not. And on the other side of the Earth to Alaska, Siberia, Beringia, that area, which scientists have shown was temperate-like conditions prior during what we call the Ice Age, on the opposite side of the Earth is Western Antarctica, and that's the side that's towards South America. And we believe that Western Antarctica, which is about the size of Europe, was temperate before the displacement and was the site of Atlantis.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's
so,
the nutshell version.
Perfect. That's perfect. So your work is based on Charles Hapgood, and Charles Hapgood wrote the book The Earth's Shifting Crust. And and tell us, I mean, he was a scientist. And he's also a teacher, professor. But how does he account for the Earth, this crust displacement? How does he describe it? And what is it that you feel is the reason that Antarctica is now the true resting place of Atlantis?
Okay, well, Charles Hapgood came up with the theory of Earth crust displacement. He originally thought that there might be a change in the Earth's axis, but when he discussed this with Albert Einstein, who he corresponded with and met with, they decided that the whole Earth, the whole axis of the Earth tilting was just too much of a thing to happen. So one of his colleagues, James Campbell, suggested, well, maybe it's just the outer crust of the Earth that moved. Because the outer crust of the Earth, although it contains all the ocean basins and all the continents, is still only 1/3 of 1% of the Earth's mass. So they believe that the crust itself shifted, and Einstein worked with Hapgood over a period of 2.5 years developing the theory. But in the end, they never really came up with a mechanism that could explain it. Came up with a number of ideas that they tested, but each time they took it to Einstein, Einstein said not sufficient force to do it. For example, they thought that maybe the weight of the ice cap on North America was because it was off center from the Earth's spin might have caused a sort of a loopy the crust to shift, but when Einstein looked at it, he said, no, that just isn't, you need more force than that, and probably the force has to be steady, and it has to be continuous, and then it has to have a stoppage as well. So in the end, both Hapgood and Einstein had basically not come up with a mechanism by which the Earth's crust shifted. However, we have there's a fellow in Florida. His name is Jared Friedan, and he worked with magnets. He did software development in a number of different games and stuff. And he became convinced through his research with magnetics that the Earth's that the Earth itself being a magnet was potentially a candidate for some sort of massive solar electronic storm. He called them solar typhoons. He believed that the sun occasionally, over much longer periods than on the Earth, have these hurricanes and tornadoes on the sun that send out charged particles throughout the solar system. And as the planet Earth enters into that shower of electrical spray from the sun, if you like, the particles hit one of the poles because the Earth is a magnet, and it then goes down into the center of the core of the Earth, which is a molten rock, and that heats it up. And that heats up the mantle, which is the next layer. And then it heats up a layer right below the crust that's called the asthenosphere, which means weak zone. And that is the, and so the move, as the Earth moves in its orbit through this electromagnetic storm, the constant pressure from the electromagnetic storm pushes the Earth's crust over. And as it leaves the orbit, it leaves the area that's being sprayed by the sun, if you like, then it stops. So we believe that his theory is the most plausible one.
Okay, so according to Plato, according to whatever, you know, we don't have a lot of recorded data on the destruction of the final phase of Atlantis. You still place it in the Atlantic Ocean, is that correct?
No, originally. It's in what? The relationship of the continents to each other doesn't change in an Earth crust displacement.
Okay.
It's the entire outer shell, includes all the ocean basins. Okay.
So everything 9,500 years ago, everything shifted in this massive upheaval. Okay.
Yeah.
So
and what it does is it moved North America out of the polar zone, which had been in the Hudson Bay, and then you get all the melting in North America, which creates the Great Lakes, and the ocean level rises about 100 meters, and you lose all the continental shelf becomes underwater, book prior to the displacement, all the continental shelves was land. So there was, before the displacement, there was more land on the Earth than there is today. There was equivalent to an extra continent like Africa. Because all the continental shelf, all the land between England and Europe, between Japan and Asia, that they weren't islands at that time. They were connected to the mainlands because there was the ocean level was much, much lower than it is now. We're living in the post-flood time period, if you like, and the ocean level has risen quite a bit since that time.
Okay.
Since the last...
So I'm constantly on the internet, and I believe about 3-4 months ago there was a series of images of what someone had thought was a pyramid that had been discovered in Antarctica. But that be it as it is, have you come up with any forms of or any reference sites of discoveries on Antarctica that might lead to an understanding that there, deep under the miles of ice, there is a civilization?
Well, at the end of the Atlantis blueprint, we make mention of a strikingly circular object that was discovered using satellite images, which we think might be the location of the city of Atlantis, because Atlantis refers not only to the continent, it also refers to the city like New York, New York. So you have Atlantis, Atlantis, and Atlantis City, if you like, about the size of London, Greater London. It was just inland from the ocean, and we call this the World Ocean because if you look at a globe, next time you have a globe and you look at it and you look at Antarctica and you ask yourself what ocean is this in, then you can't use the European concepts of Pacific, Atlantic, Indian because it's one continuous ocean. And oceanographers recognize that there is only one ocean. It's called the World Ocean. We have subdivided the World Ocean into different parts for the convenience of the European explorers to refer to, oh, this is the way to India, that's the Indian Ocean. This is the peaceful ocean compared to going through the Straits of Gibraltar. Magellan named it the Pacific Ocean, the peaceful ocean. But there aren't really separate oceans. There's only one ocean. And that notion of a single ocean in which an island continent is in the center of it is one of the central parts of Plato's story of Atlantis. And everything that we know about Atlantis comes from Plato. So that's important to realize that we're not talking about the Atlantic Ocean, we're talking about the World Ocean.
Does Plato give reference to... a cataclysm. Of course, it would be hard for him to explain Earth crust displacement. I don't think he would even get anything close to that. But does he describe?
Well, actually, he did. Yeah,
oh,
he
does
did.
He? How does
yes,
he describe
because,
it?
Okay, well, what it is, here's the thing. Plato is recording a story that was told to him by his ancestors. It goes back a couple of centuries, to the time of Solon, who was his ancestor on his mother's side. Solon is the person who was the Greek who went to Egypt and received the story of Atlantis from the most learned priest there. And that priest what happened is when Solon got there, he said to the priest, you know, well, we know about a great flood, and we know this and that and everything. And the Egyptian priest said, oh, Solon, you Greeks are but children, for you remember nothing compared to what we have. We have written records of a great destruction that occurred 9,000 years ago, and this conversation took place around 600 B.C., so that's 9,600 B.C. is what he's talking about. And he says that there is a truth in the Greek myth of Phaethon. Phaethon was the son of the sun god who rode the chariots of the sun that the Greeks believed that the each morning they four horses, winged horses, drawn by a chariot driven by Helios, the sun god, dragged the sun across the sky behind him. Phaethon, being a son of Helios, persuaded Helios that to be able to drive the chariots of the sun, and he was unable to control them. So the sun veered from its normal path and caused a great fire, and then to put out the fire, Zeus brought the flood. So there's a change in the sky. The sky doesn't seem to be, the sun doesn't seem to be going in its normal path, and that's what happens with an Earth crust displacement, you see. Each day, the sun rises on a different horizon today. But during an Earth crust displacement, there's radical changes of as the crust moves, it seems as though the sky is falling, or the sun is falling. And there's myths all around the world that talk about the sun falling, that the sun being responsible for the flood by falling or not going through its normal course, or the stars falling. And so there is reference. And what Zonkas, who is the name of the priest who spoke to Solon, said is there is truth in your myth that there are real physical events that occur that cause these great destructions, including the great flood.
And
so there was a reference
in that. Okay, but what is your sense on the time for this massive Earth displacement, this crust displacement? Is it something that happens in a matter of days, or is it a month or week? Because we're talking a global displacement, right?
Yes, we're talking about 30 degrees. We're talking about the Hudson, the crust being where the axis is. The North Pole was in the Hudson Bay, and then ending up in what we call the Arctic Ocean. So it's 30 degrees, and so North America as a continent went 30 degrees closer to the equator. All the ice that had been on North America during the time it was in the polar zone melts. So, now the timing is controversial. Hapgood himself, who I corresponded with, never believed that it happened very quickly. He thought it took 4,000 or 5,000 years to happen.
Okay.
However, when I did my research, you have these eyewitnesses, throughout the world. There's all these accounts from First Nation people, Native people throughout the world who talk about the sky falling, and that's why we called our first book When the Sky Fell. And after the sky falls, the great flood comes. So we're thinking probably weeks or months, not years or decades or even millennia.
Okay. As sophisticated as the Atlanteans were, they must have known that this huge geological event was about to happen to them. Their influence, in my opinion, is everywhere. Do you have a sense? I study and continue to study the Mayan civilization as a potential place where Atlanteans may have landed. And they are the, progenitors, the people who eventually became the Mayas, my theory. Do you have any thoughts on great areas where Atlanteans may have settled around the world?
Yes. The thing about it is the Egyptian priest Zonkas told Plato's ancestor Solon that it was 9,000 years before their time. So that pinpoints the date to 9,600 BC. Now that is, and they didn't have radiocarbon dating, they didn't have any of that, but nowadays we now recognize that is the end of what's called the end of the last ice age, and that this is the critical time that things are occurring was around 11,500 years ago. So what was happening in the world then is the big question. And the thing that's most significant that as far as our civilization is concerned is that suddenly throughout the world, in North America, South America, Africa, Asia, Europe, there's suddenly people who have been living by hunting and gathering for maybe 100,000 years suddenly start to turn to agriculture. And we have agricultural experiments in happening simultaneously around the world around 9,600 BC. And we think that that's the influence of the Atlanteans. They had a civilization based upon agriculture. They made us some of their plants might have survived, but most of their plants were destroyed when their land was sucked into the polar zone, the Antarctic circle. So they had to start from scratch again, but it happens simultaneously that it's happening in the Middle East. It's also happening in South America. It's also happening in Mexico. It's happening in China. It's happening in India. So the fact that humanity has been living by hunting and gathering for probably 100,000, 200,000 years, depending on how old you think humanity is, how you define humanity, suddenly all throughout the world we have this abrupt change to agriculture. That, I think, is the biggest legacy that the Atlanteans gave us, was the idea of agriculture, which then, of course, allows us to develop a civilization.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because I study megaliths with some other researchers, and it seems that there's tremendous similarities in very old pyramids, the Maya, the Indian pyramids, Cambodian pyramids. They're not anything close to the Great Pyramids of Giza Plateau in Egypt. Those are quite unique, and I'm not even sure that that pyramid is the same class of a pyramid that you see in the Yucatan Peninsula where the Maya were. But there are tremendous similarities, and I've always wondered if there were a group of people who were teaching the locals how to build these pyramids. And I always have wondered if it could have been, maybe the Atlanteans were the ones who went out and discussed and showed the engineering that was needed to build them. What do you think about that?
Well, basically, the Atlantis blueprint, which I wrote with Colin Wilson, the English writer, that is basically what we're saying there. What happened, we believe, is that after the displacement of the Earth's crust, the Atlanteans had maps of the world, but now the maps did not match the latitudes. So they had to go around the world, remapping the world to find out where they were. I mean, and ultimately what they did is they found that because of the new position of the Earth's crust as it is today, that there was one natural place in the world that was the center of the world in a sense, and that turned out to be Giza. And so they believed, we believe that Giza was sighted shortly after 9,600 BC. From there, then they started to put up markers at intervals from that. So if you look, for example, if we go from west to east, Easter Island is 140 degrees west of Giza. The Teotihuacan in Mexico City, where the Great Pyramid of the Sun, which has the same footprint as the Great Pyramid of Giza, is 130. Then there's all these Mayan sites, Chichen Itza, Copan, Lupanum, that are at 120 degrees west. Then at 110, there's Quito, the northern capital of the Inca Empire. And then at 100, there's Teotihuacan that you were talking about at the beginning of the show. That's 100 degrees west. So you have these 10 degree intervals places that are on a Giza prime meridian. So that cannot be coincidence. That has to have been done deliberately. So the sighting of the locations was done by the Atlanteans. Now, it took many, many years, and even centuries, and even thousands of years, before the rudimentary agriculture that the Atlanteans endowed us when they landed throughout the rest of the world was sufficiently developed to turn into a civilization that could do something. And we don't know where they might have been and living during this time. It's not impossible that parts of Antarctica were still being used as a base, but we don't know the answer to that. However, it does seem as though when you look at, for example, Carthage is a concentric circles of city. So is the ones in Mexico City is concentric circles. And that is what the Plato describes as the city of Atlantis. It was concentric circles. So there is an influence of the Atlanteans on the development of civilizations throughout the world is our bottom line.
But okay. It was yeah.
Yeah, there was a big delay.
Yeah.
There's a dark age.
You know, I also wanted to talk to you about your knowledge on Atlantis. You've dig up and you have found some interesting aspects of the actual technology that came out of the place we know as a myth. Still, unfortunately, we only can call it a myth, even though we want to, you know, prove it to be a factual place. But it seems to me, in my research and that of other researchers, that there was an understanding of energetics, earth energetics, be it gravity, atmosphere, things like that, that is imbued in a number of these ancient sites. And there is a couple of different researchers who have actually measured the energy that is emitted naturally from the ground, and then through just a genius level of engineering, a temple or a pyramid is placed on top of these geo emissions and actually amplifies those emissions. And then how it's used after that, we just don't know, because we're just not sophisticated enough. But is it your understanding that the technology at the time of the last destruction of Atlantis was fairly significant?
Well, all we can say for certain is that they had mapped the entire planet, because the description of the location of Atlantis, given in Plato, mm-hmm. is an accurate description of the Earth's geography as seen from Antarctica. And people who want to look at that can see that on our website at Atlantis in Antarctica. But our website is flemeth.com. Fleming, taking a bath. If you take out the B and put in a hyphen, you've got Flem.
Wonderful.
Okay.
I'll post that on the website.
Okay, so what we're saying here, now you're talking about other technologies that may have existed, I certainly see that people have come up with good reasons to believe that, because of similarities of artifacts that they're finding in, for example, these metal clamps that they found in Giza, and they also find in Mexico, that hold pieces of stone together. They're almost identical. They look like, kind of like a dog biscuit, you know, but they're holding the stones together. And it means that they have some sort of portable ability to melt metal and carry it around. And we discussed that in a little bit in Atlantis Blueprint. So, yeah, I think that there is remnants of evidence to suggest that the Atlanteans were an advanced civilization. And certainly that's what Plato says. And Plato's description of the city of Atlantis makes the pyramids seem like playthings, because the scale on which the city of Atlantis was built, it was just vast. Like I said, it was the size of Greater London. And if those things are as true as the other things that he said, then their engineering capabilities were far beyond what we can do today.
Yeah, okay.
So they might be more advanced than other things, too, is what I'm saying.
Well, the thing is, we don't have the technology to really measure unseen fields other than measure their strength or weakness. And acrylic photography can take pictures of it, but you, there's, I don't know of any new system that can take a picture of a field and see, I mean, from a pyramid and see the intensity. So what those fields are doing, how they're used, well, is beyond me.
Yeah, like, for example, all the mica that was in the Pyramid of the Sun and all the mica that was in Mexico that was taken from South America and brought, and people have ripped all that mica off, but we don't know what that was being used for. I mean, why would they go to such a great effort to bring mica from South America to Mexico and layer the pyramids with this if not for some purpose that we yet don't understand?
Let's talk about cartography, because you have a big section of the book on a number of maps that you believe were copies from much, much earlier maps that may have been linked to an advanced civilization. Let's discuss. I'm gonna say it. I'm not sure I'm gonna say it correctly. Is it the Piri Reis map?
Yeah, that's one.
Okay, that is a quite unique a map. Can you talk a little bit about what is sophisticated? Now, to my understanding, the only way that map could have been created is through an elevated view of the planet. In other words, at some point there was some kind of a craft that could go up a high enough to see the Earth from a atmospheric level, looking down, almost as not quite as high as a satellite, but pretty high up.
Well, I don't know if that's the case or not, but I will tell you this: that the projection that the Piri Reis on, the Piri Reis is only a fragment of a larger map that has been lost. Now, the fragment that has existed is on a particular type of projection. It's called an equidistance projection, a zimonal equidistance projection. That kind of projection was used during the Cold War, and what it really does is it takes a spot on the Earth, say Moscow or Washington, D.C., and then it shows the world from that perspective. And then you can, from concentric circles, you can see how close you can get to that target in any place. Like, for Turkey is very close to Moscow, for example. Cuba is very close to Washington. So that projection is the projection that the Piri Reis is based upon, which is relatively modern projection. The Piri Reis was originally discovered in 1929 in Istanbul, a former Constantinople, when they were moving a museum, and they found this map, and it was drawn on a deer skin, and so that it was well preserved. It dates from 1513, and it shows parts of Europe, but it shows almost all the eastern coast of South America. And it shows subglacial features of what's called Western Antarctica. So beneath, and the thing that this was not realized until 1958, I think it was, when Charles Hapgood had a mentor of his own. His name was Arlington Mallory. And he was a researcher who was in Washington, D.C., and he was reading a journal about Antarctica in 1958, which was the geophysical year. And he had a map of the subglacial features of Antarctica for the first time we'd ever had that. And in comes somebody else who was working in the map department there, and said to Mallory, "Hey, I've got a copy of the Piri Reis map. Do you want to see it?" And Mallory said, "Sure, I'd like to see it." And he said, "Can I take it home?" And he said, "Okay, yeah, sure, take it home." So he took it home, and he compared the subglacial features from the 1958 journal from the Norwegian seismic surveys of Antarctica with the map of the Peary Reese map, and he found that it was accurate. And this was so startling to him that then when he came back to him, he said, I'm going to hand this over to you now, to the U.S. Navy. I'm going to hand it over to you guys and the cartographical people in the Navy, and you look at this because you won't believe it if I say it. So then they did it, and the U.S. Navy and the naval cartographical department went through it, and they said, no, this is accurate within half a degree longitude, which is extremely accurate, for subglacial features of Antarctica. Subsequently, later, Mallory went on a radio show, and one of Charles Hapgood's students heard the radio show. There's a place where radio shows make history, and then Hapgood then did another investigation of it. He took it from scratch as if Mallory hadn't done anything, and instead of using the U.S. Navy, he used the U.S. Air Force, and they came to the same conclusion. And
wow.
They both came back and said, these maps are showing, these are accurate within half a degree of longitude on number of places in subglacial Antarctica and the entire eastern coast of South America. The thing that's, and it's dated from 1513. Now, Europeans weren't capable of determining longitude at sea until the 1770s. Captain Cook was the very first person who had the capability, because he had an extremely accurate marine chronometer, to be able to determine longitude at sea. He was the first person who could actually start to map continents. This is 200 years after two and a half centuries after the Peary Reese is already showing the accurate long eastern coast of South America and the subglacial features of Antarctica. So what we're saying here is that there are a series of maps, and the Peary Reese is just one. There are a series of maps that survived. See, what happens when there's a great displacement of the Earth's crust and a flood, if you like? The people who survive are in boats. And the people in the boat have two skills. They have astronomy. They know astronomy for navigation, and they have maps. And those are the things that are the most ancient things. Astronomy is so ancient around the world. In many, many places around the world, the knowledge of the local people exceeds what should be possible. And the reason is that the survivors from Atlantis brought astronomy and they brought maps. Now these maps show the world as it was before the displacement. So you wouldn't know, it wouldn't say North America on it. It would just be a continuous land mass. So when Christopher Columbus eventually got his hands on the Peary Reese map, amongst others, he had a map of the world. But he didn't know nothing was labeled India, because India didn't exist. All they had was land. And he knew that there was land to the west, but he thought it was India. And so when he went there, he thought he'd discovered India. But he had a map that told him to go there.
Right.
And that map ultimately came from Atlantis.
It's a unique map from the perspective of how it's laid out. And do you or anyone that you have spoken to about this Peary Reese map have an idea of how it was actually composed? We know it was copied many, many, many times, but it's an elevated look in such a way that it's very
tempting to believe that there is an aerial perspective on this. I understand where you're coming from. That is very, very. That seems to be the logical conclusion. But you can't know that for certain. You can't one way or the other. You can't say that. But one thing I can say about it, which is a unique thing that we put in Atlantis Beneath the Ice, is the date and when it was originally constructed. And what we did was when you find the center of the Pyrenees map on which the pressure projection is made, then you have a spot that you can compare to the Tropic of Cancer, because we believe that the map was constructed when the Tropic of Cancer went through what's now called Aswan. It was called Sien at the time in Egypt. And you can calculate the difference because the Earth's tilt is very gradually changing. We're going from 22.2 to 24.4, and we're at 23.5 right now. It's a very gradual change that the tilt of the Earth is having, and that there's a slow drift of the Tropic of Cancer, if you like. That can be measured, and you can determine when the last time the Tropic of Cancer went over Aswan, and that's where the center of the map is. And that was 3,800 B.C.
Oh, my God.
Nearly 6,000 years ago. And it corresponds with the earliest stages of the Egyptian civilization. And it's located near the Valley of the Kings, where a lot of the pharaohs were buried. So we do believe that the Pyrenees map, because of its projection and because of the astronomy, that you can calculate when it was originally constructed, and that was 3,800 B.C. So it's really...
Wow, that is amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
You reference the Hapgood book, The Earth's Shifting Crust, which does have another number of... maps in it. Is there another map that is as dynamic as the Pyrenees map that you think is a good indication from a much earlier advanced civilization mapping the Earth?
Yes, I think. Well, I discovered one map that I believe is the most accurate map of Antarctica without its ice that existed before 1958. And that is what's called the Kirker map of Atlantis. Kirker, Athanasius Kirker, was a German Jesuit priest, lived in the 16th century. He was as famous in his time as Albert Einstein was in the 20th century. He was considered the most learned person. And he was brought to Rome by the Pope to take over... cataloging all the stuff that the Jesuits were bringing from around the world into Rome. And they were taking it from everywhere, as you well know. And one of the things that he claims to have found was a map of Atlantis that had come from Egypt. There is references to a map of Atlantis in some ancient literature as well that sort of substantiate it. Anyway, his map of Atlantis, which is, again, if you look on Atlantis and Antarctica on our website, you'll be able to see the map. It shows he thought that it was in the mid-Atlantic because what happened with the Atlantic thing was that the word Atlantic at one time meant something different than it does today. At the time of Plato and Solon and Zonkas and that the story of Atlantis was told, the Atlantic referred to a body of water that went all the way around the Earth. Okay, so it was to the west of Europe, but it was also north, south, east. So, and we believe that was the world ocean. But by the time Kirker came along in 1680 or something like that, the word Atlantic had been dwarfed down to the size of the North Atlantic Ocean. So when he read Plato, he thought this map was that he had found from Egypt was a map of an island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. So he put it into his book. 1665 book. I had a copy at one time, and it was published in 1665. Now, what we say is, if you take that same map and you compare it to what the geophysical map of the Earth was north down and south up, so that you're looking at Antarctica and South America's on the right, Africa's on the left, that it is a remarkably accurate map of Antarctica without the ice. And that's, we believe, that the Kircher map is of the Kircher map of Atlantis is actually an accurate map of subglacial Antarctica.
And so that map must have been copied from a much, 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 much earlier map of the Earth, obviously. And without the ice, that would be, what, the Pleistocene period, which is 100,000 years ago, right?
Well, yeah, it's a little bit complicated because, like, really we're only talking about a third of Antarctica. Antarctica is a gigantic continent. It's as big as North America. Okay, so we're only talking about, in terms of where they lived, they only lived on the side that was towards South America. The other side, like the side that's towards Australia or South Africa, was all ice. It was still in the polar zone, even during the reign of Atlantis. But the ocean level would be different as well, you see. So the configuration that you get when you take all the ice off, it shows Antarctica looks like a much skeleton compared to what the Kircher map looks like, because the Kircher map has the old ocean levels. But when we take it off now, we take it to the current ocean level, so it's not quite accurately. But as we explored this, we believe that the Kircher map of Atlantis is the most accurate map of Antarctica without its ice that existed ever, I think, believe. And the Peary Reef, of course, is remarkable because of the latitude, the longitude accuracies. But it does. It only takes a fragment of Antarctica, whereas the Kircher map is all of the Antarctica.
Okay, but I mean, what is your estimation? Well, what's your hypothesis on the true age of the original map? How old do you think that would be?
Oh, the original map is 11,500 years ago old. When Zonka spoke to Solon about Atlantis, he says that he mentions there are written records from that time, and we can go and look at them later after I've told you my story. So presumably, and this isn't included in the story, Solon was taken to some place in Egypt where Zonka showed him written records from Atlantis, which included maps, and this was probably one of the maps that he saw, but he wouldn't have been able to comprehend it because he didn't have a concept of what the world was composed of. So it was beyond his knowledge to be able to understand it. It wasn't until our time that we could see it. It wasn't until 1958 that we knew that, for example, that Antarctica wasn't one big solid piece of ice like it is represented on most maps even today. It looks like kind of a brain with a stem towards South America. But in reality, that stem are a series of islands, and there's a mainland, and then there's a bunch of little islands. And those are shown in the Kircher map of Atlantis, centuries before, like three centuries before we knew what was under the ice.
And has the Navy or the Air Force studied that map that you know of?
No, I haven't asked them to do that. The climate is different nowadays. I don't think that would happen as easily as it was. In the 50s and the 60s when Mallory and Hapgood were working, it was much easier just to walk in and
knock on the door and say, "Hey, take a look."
Yeah, say, "Could you look at this?" And they would do that. Nowadays, the bureaucracies are just unbelievable.
Yeah, those maps are fascinating. I want to touch base a little bit in the remaining time we have on the question of America and the populating of America as it relates to Atlantis. What can you tell me about that? Is there an influence that you have detected from a civilization of advanced notion populating America?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Again, on our website, there's a section under favorite posts called Peopling of America. Here's the deal. This is really interesting. I live on Vancouver Island in British Columbia, and just north of us, there's another island that's just at the southern tip of Alaska. It's called Haida Gwaii. There are little islands there. If you imagine that Alaska is kind of a question mark, this would be the point, would just below the panhandle. That's called Haida Gwaii. Now, from the perspective of Haida Gwaii, before the displacement, the pole, the North Pole, was in the Hudson Bay. So that was what directly east in our calculations today. And the North Pole was west to compare it. So what happened was, before the displacement of the Earth's crust from Haida Gwaii, Alaska wasn't to the north; it was to the west of Haida Gwaii, and California was to the east of Haida Gwaii, not the south. So somebody traveling on water along the Alaska coastline could go all the way through to Haida Gwaii, all the way down to California, and they would be traveling from west to east. So it's a different kind of we have a radical different perspective on the peopling of America. We think that America was easily populated from the rest of from the Euro-Asian continent because of the position of the Earth's crust before the last displacement. It was one continuous landmass. You could go from Siberia into a land that doesn't exist anymore called Beringia, and you could go along the Alaska coast all the way down to California, and you would not be encountering big ice sheets or anything like that. So we believe that that's one way. But here's the more significant thing. When you look at the people like the Haida, and there's a number of other ones in America, like the Okanagan and the Utes and the Aztecs, they all have a story of a land that existed before the flood. And frequently that land that existed before the flood was an island.
Right.
I'd like to just, yeah. So here's one thing that works well on radio, that it's easier than maps and stuff like you're doing visually, is the sound pattern of the name of the lost island paradise that existed before the flood. In the Okanagan, which is in British Columbia and Washington State now, that's the area that we're talking about, in the Rockies. They're not on an island. They're in the Rockies. The Okanagan have a story of their ancestral home, which they called Suma Tui Wula. Da-da, da-da, da-da. It's like na-na-na-na-na-na. Okay? So, now go to Japan, and they have an island that existed at the very big, the primordial time, called Onogorojima. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Then you go to ancient Iran, and they have a place called Arianavejo. Da-da-da-da-da-da. So, what we have here... We have in North America, we have in Japan, and we have in Iran, the same sound pattern, meaning the same thing, which is the island, original island homeland that existed before the flood. And it goes da-da-da-da-da-da, whether it's Onogorojima, Arianavejo, Suma Tui Wula, the sound pattern is exactly the same, referring to an island that existed before the flood. So that's where I say that, yes, I believe the Haida, I believe the Okanagan, I believe the Cherokee have another one as well. They all have Cherokee have a myth of a great island, I mean a great land that exists where the climate is opposite to ours, which is a reference to the southern hemisphere, in my view. So when you explore North American mythology and you connect it with mythology around the world, you do get this larger theme than Atlantis, which is the lost island paradise theme. So I believe that, yes, there was a huge influence of the Atlanteans in America. The population, it's generally agreed that although there's questions about who was when they came and everything, it's generally we're pushing it back before 9,600 now. However, there's one thing that can be said is that around 9,600, there seems to be an influx of population into the Americas. Now, where they came from is always assumed to be Siberia, but that's not what the people say. If you take the people who live in Tiahuanaco that you were mentioning in at the beginning of the show, in the high central Andes, they say they are the children of the sun and that they came from the deep south at the time of the flood. So they're saying that their ancestors came from the direction of Antarctica after the flood. And
right.
We believe that probably true.
Do you find that the mound builders, and there's literally thousands and thousands of mounds in
yeah.
the United States, do you see a correlation with that, with those people and Atlantis, or is it more of a just a general populating, and because they're so ancient, the mound builders are kind of the generations after the original people?
I believe the mound dwellers have situated their mounds with reference to a sophisticated knowledge of geography. However, I can't really go into that because this is a friend of mine has made a major breakthrough on this, and we'll probably hear.
Aha.
I'll give you it, when it comes out. I'll make sure that you see it. This is going to be one of the mind-shattering events of 2015 is when
yeah,
his book comes out.
We've heard it here first, folks. News from Rand on a new book on ancient America. Well, that's
yes,
fantastic.
Well,
no, I'm just
well,
curious.
It's worldwide.
Oh, it's
but
a worldwide.
But for the first time, it really shows how America fits in.
Oh, okay. Wonderful. Well, I mean, it's just America is such a unique place, and there's so much great suppression by the scientific community on our early people, not just Native Americans, but more and more is coming up on the people. I call them the pre-flood people who settled and lived in on the East Coast, but there's more information on parts of California and things like that. So I'm always curious.
And Brazil as well.
And
also Chile.
Hmm.
Yeah, here's one of the things that we talk about in Atlantis Beneath the Ice. The chapter 10 is called The Broken Paradigm, which is about the existing paradigm about how people arrived in America. And what we found was that, finally, there's now a new generation of anthropologists, archaeologists in South America who are not conditioned by the fixations and assumptions of Europeans and North Americans about their own prehistory. And they're developing different theories about what's happening. And so this is a very exciting time in terms of archaeology in South America, particularly because for the first time, indigenous people who have the skills are actually looking at things not through the prisms provided by Europeans and North Americans, but by their own experiences and what's on the ground. And that's going to change everything over the next 20 years, I believe. And that's
mm-hmm.
why the broken paradigm of the people in America, it's based. You know what it is? It's a projection of the American experience of the exploration of the West. It was we came here voluntarily, we conquered the land, we went across, and we had opportunity, and we took it. That's what they painted onto the indigenous people. But what the indigenous people say is completely different. What they say, and it's unanimous on this, what they say is we were catastrophically displaced from a paradise. And we survived in boats, or we climbed mountains, and we got away from the flood, and then we had to start the whole thing over again. We weren't here because through expiration. We were here through catastrophe. We were climatic refugees. That's what the people of that's what the Haida say. That's what all throughout America. That's what they say about their story, and it's completely different from what the anthropologists are trying to shove down their throat.
Well, that's what's so hard for me is to read these early archaeologists, anthropologists who were in Central America uncovering the great Mayan cities and saying that they were savages and that they their inception date was just a few thousand years ago, and they're not really paying attention to the traditions of the people who are actually left there. And the elders who I've spoke to in Central America say that our people are ancient, and that our ancestors were the ones who built these pyramids and these temples. We didn't build them. We came back and settled them after the Great Flood. And it's amazing that because it's an oral tradition and there's no codices left, that science poo-poos it. And it just drives me nuts. It's completely.
Well, you know, that whole thing is cracking right open. That whole paradigm is falling apart. The first, it was falling apart first because of the whole idea of the Pleistocene hunters as being the only the earliest people. Well, we now well know now. Through sites in South America and America, but particularly sites in South America, that you know people were living in the Americas long before the big game hunters came along. They were living there, and so that was just an episode, but it wasn't the big event that archaeology, North American archaeology, assumes it to be.
Yeah, I mean they have to see it as a written document before they take it in and even consider it. But I think if you look at well, it's true. It's really true. And luckily, we know that a lot of the thought, at least in the Americas, behind the science is changing because they keep radiocarbon dating ruins and the dates are going back and back and back. We now know from El Mirador in Guatemala, that the Maya were contemporaries of the Olmec. And that is a mind blower because if they were contemporaries, that means that they are thousands of years older than is currently projected in history books. And that's the other problem is that our history books are so way off that it's almost a crime that we have to subject our students to this false history.
Well, you know textbooks are like brochures to another country. Come and see Paris. It's all wonderful. They don't tell you about the sewers or anything like that. Or, you know, come to some – what textbooks are is what – they want you to think the place is going to be, right? It's not what reality is. It's what they've decided reality should be. And that's what people who do brochures and the tourist bureaus and all that do for countries, and archaeologists and anthropologists and scientists in general do that for their own sciences as well. They try to make it, they simplify it, and they try to codify it, and it seems all rational and coherent. However, when you actually get there, you find out it's not what's actually happening. And that's what's happening now with the peopling of America. This is a broken paradigm, and it's going to be overturned. And I'm so glad that the South Americans are going to be the ones that do it.
Let's quickly move to Turkey in our last few minutes, and I want to get your take on the fantastic Göbekli Tepe and what you think about that as it relates to your knowledge of Atlantis. So what do you think about that place?
Göbekli Tepe is the biggest archaeological discovery of all time to date, in my view. Only 10% of it has been excavated. Here's the thing that's so significant about it. For a couple of 100,000 people, 100,000 years, modern humans were living by hunting and gathering. Then suddenly, at Göbekli Tepe, they start building 18-foot-high T-shaped stone pillars that weigh 16 tons each. Now, how does that happen? Building up that skills. You don't have these little towers that are falling over, these little pillars that aren't working. You have suddenly, and it's exactly the same century that Atlantis was destroyed, according to Plato, 9,600 B.C., you have in Göbekli Tepe the first monumental architecture in the world that we can date. And that is the earliest. I mean, and the amazing thing about it is it's twice as old as we thought architecture was. Previous to the discovery of Göbekli Tepe, everybody believed that the oldest architectural in the world was on Malta, and it was about 6,000 years old. And it was just older than the pyramids, older than the stuff in Britain and all that. And that's the oldest place in the world was on Malta. But this is twice as old as that. And the thing about it is you suddenly have people who, like, you know, how did that skill arrive? I mean, they're ignoring this whole thing about the masonry skill required to build, a 16-foot, an 18-foot stone pillar that looks like a T-shaped thing. It's just one
right.
solid piece.
Yeah.
And it weighs 16 tons. 500 people are required to move it, even an inch, and it's being brought from a fair distance away, uphill, to the site. The archaeologists are completely baffled about that. And not only are they baffled, they completely ignore. What they focus is on, they call it a temple, and that it's the foundation of agriculture. People wanted to come. That's a bunch of bull. What was happening was, simultaneous to the construction of Göbekli Tepe, within a 100-mile radius, there's all sorts of archaeological sites that were wheat is being domesticated, barley is being domesticated, sheep are being domesticated, rabbits, goats, all happening at the same century that Göbekli Tepe is happening. And now the German archaeologists who's running the excavation at Göbekli Tepe is saying that the temple caused people to turn to agriculture to support the people who were pilgrimaging to the site. But what he fails to explain is how they built the thing in the first place. Where's the experiment that led to, you have little pillars and then you have bigger pillars, and there is none. You start off with the best and the most skilled pillars at Göbekli Tepe are the oldest ones. And then as time goes by, they aren't able to do what they were able to do at the time of Atlantis. And a century later, the pillars are smaller. A millennium later, they're even smaller. And then they cover the whole thing up again, cover it in mountains. So we have no idea why a mountain of dirt. Why they did that, we don't have no idea. But the thing about Göbekli Tepe is that it's the first monumental architecture in the world, and it's twice as old as what we thought monumental architecture was. And it dates to the very century when Atlantis was destroyed. And we say that the Atlanteans were influential on the origins of agriculture. They were also influential in stonemasonry. And that is a big part of Plato's account of Atlantis, is the stonemasonry that occurs in the city of Atlantis. So rather than being a temple to create religion, we believe this was survivors from Atlantis who had the skills, who used their skills. They might have even had technologies that were still working to construct these pristine, big 16-ton blocks, and then that attracted the people. And then the people were in taught how to do agriculture, and then the whole thing gets started. So it's our take on what's happening at Göbekli Tepe is completely different from what the archaeologists who are there, and I think ours is more coherent, and theirs is, they completely ignore how the masonry suddenly occurs.
So your take, Rand, is similar to Graham Hancock and Colin, or Andrew Colin, which is that it was a civic center, a center for learning. And I recently read that they have found that parts of it were used for observatory too, which means that the astronomy aspect was in was there also. Is that your feeling
absolutely.
Too?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Again, as I said before, survivors of Atlantis were people who sailed the seas, and they knew astronomy. So it isn't surprising that the astronomy should show up there. And,
it's amazing.
And
it's
so
an
amazing
place.
As well.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you. The book is called Atlantis Beneath the Ice. The author is Rand and Rose Flemdoff, and I always ask authors before we conclude, are you going to be speaking anywhere this summer that people can go and hear you talk? Are you going to be at any conferences in the next few months that we can go see you?
No, not really, but I do have a new book that will be coming out in December. And it's not related to Atlantis at all. It's a completely radical retelling of the Bible. And I think it's the most controversial book I've ever done. And my wife and I are preparing for the release of that in December of this year.
Well,
and there'll be stuff on our website about that. And I'd like to discuss that with you.
Well, we'll definitely have to have you on for that. So is it a revisionist look at the Bible, or is it just a new take based
on... It's a complete retelling of the first five books of the Bible.
Oh, the,
based
oh,
upon,
the old chapter.
I spent 12 years researching this.
Oh, fascinating, Rand. We'll have to definitely get you on the program for that. It's been a pleasure. I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Again, the book's Atlantis Beneath the Ice. I will post your website on the page. The book is available on the Inner Traditions website, which is innertraditions.com. And I believe I saw it a few weeks ago on Amazon, so it's
it's available on Amazon and all the online bookstores.
Right, and it's the most up to date view of your hypothesis on the Antarctica being the original Atlantis. So wonderful,
that's
fantastic!
Right.
I really enjoyed speaking with you. And again, I'll be in contact. We want to hear about this new book that's coming out. When do you think that's going to be published? In December, you said?
It'll be either late November or early December.
Wonderful. We'll have to look forward to it. So that's it for today. Thanks. And stay tuned for next week. And be sure to keep an eye on the Facebook page, because there is a whole new series of photos that are placed there that were the first ever shot of the Sacred Valley in Peru, which includes Machu Picchu, Cusco, and Sacsayhuaman when they first discovered it. It's one of the first series of photographs that were taken. So please take a look at that. Next week.